Who doesn't like spoilers? Here at Big Red Potion, we're sure that everybody loves a good spoiler, so we're pleased to tell you that this episode is brimming with the Blighters. Yes, if you're looking for spoilers on Silent Hill 2, Dead Space, Grand Theft Auto 4, Fallout 3, Mad World, Metal Gear Solid 3, Mass Effect, Final Fantasy 7, Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare, The Passage, and Heavenly Sword. Then keep listening for some plot ruinery. This is Big Red Potion. Now part of the Unified Gamers Network, you are listening to Big Red Potion, the podcast that still believes in the Duke. I'm your imperative host, Sinan Kuba, staff writer and associate editor for the Game Reviews, and as always, I'm joined by the man who puts the crazy into crazy taxi, TGR Previews director Joseph D'Elia. Now, before we hear from Joe, I should say that I was lucky enough to do a guest spot on CrankyGamersUK.net's podcast with Toz yesterday, which you can check out at that website address. But anyway, Toz told me to tell you, Joe, that you're very good at the podcasting. So there you go.
Wow. That's incredible. Did I ever mention how brilliant and attractive that I found Toz? Because he is a wonderful man. But yeah, I can't wait to listen to your guest spot on the CGUK podcast. It sounds fantastic.
Oh, thank you. He had lots of praise for you. So anyway, if you want to check that out, it's at crankygamersuk.net. But anyway, on to our guests. And first up, well, only up this week, we've had a bit of trouble getting hold of our second guest, but we do have our first guest, which is Jared Newman, correspondent, reporter, and blogger for Technologizer, CD Freaks, and Gear Crave, respectively. As well as once being TGR's news director, Jared has contributed articles to Wired Magazine and The Escapist, including an article on today's subject matter, which I'm sure will come up. So, Jared, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, and that's a really lovely bio you put together there.
Well, I may have possibly cut and pasted it from your website, but the listeners don't have to know that. So anyway, on to our show topic, and this week we're going to be continuing last week's discussion on death in video games, except looking more at the morbid side of death rather than the game over side. As the pre-show warning stated, we're going to be talking in quite a lot of detail with quite a lot of spoilers about certain relevant games, considering how they handle the demise of their player characters. We're going to be bringing it all together and considering how far gaming has come along in its handling of death, how far it has to go, which games have challenged death as a construct, which games have ducked out during their characters' last minutes. And really, in all, we're going to consider whether gaming's loose handling of death, you know, trivializes its gravity, and whether, as a real-life element, death is something that gaming is right to shy away from overall. Anyway, those are some of the questions we'll be trying to answer today. And to start us off, I thought I'd ask our guest, Jared, just about some of the memorable deaths in gaming narrative that he's experienced in his time with video games. So, Jared, which character deaths, or, you know, characters which were close to the hero that died, which ones stand out to you?
Well, I think this is indicative of what I'm probably going to be railing on a little bit, but really the only thing that stood out to me, just, you know, thinking back without doing a lot of, you know, going through my whole library or anything, was the death, or at least just the possible death, of Erdnot Rex in Mass Effect. Did you guys play Mass Effect?
Absolutely.
I still haven't finished it, actually.
So there's a standoff where this character is one of your allies, is kind of a big, meaty, alien-like creature, and there comes a point where he realizes he can do something to try to, like, save his race of creatures, and it comes to head with the main character, and you're standing off, and basically you can either try to put this whole thing to rest peacefully, or you can escalate it, and it ends up with this character dying. And it's, you know, it's pretty, that doesn't happen a lot in games, where you're kind of faced with that situation. It's usually, if a character dies, you don't really have any control or it's, you know, it's part of the cutscene or what have you. So that stood out to me.
I was completely depressed by that particular moment in Mass Effect because to save that character, you have to have your speech ability up to a certain level, and I didn't at that point in the game. And he was my absolute favorite character in the game. Every time he opened his mouth, just a stupid, gleeful smile came to my face. And when I couldn't save him, it really, like, really depressed me for the rest of the game. And I was very angry that I couldn't change that. So definitely Rex had a huge effect on the way I played Mass Effect.
Yeah, I didn't know that because I was totally Paragon the whole way through. So I was in the clear. But I did play through the scene a couple times to see, you know, what would happen if I tried it a different way, and I definitely saw the couple of ways that he could have bit the bullet, so to speak.
Is he the only character who can possibly die in that game, or can, you know, the other characters in the party bite the bullet, so to speak?
No, there's another crucial moment there where you can basically choose between this other comrade of yours, another human-like character, or this chick that you may or may not be courting in the game, and it's That didn't hit me as much because it was kind of contrived. It was sort of this moment where, oh, you have to choose between one character or the other, and it seemed kind of forced, you know, where suddenly you get to this situation and there's nothing you can do about it. It wasn't really as meaningful as the situation with Rex.
Kind of like the Grand Theft Auto sort of choosing between one character or the other type thing, which I admit, which you probably come onto later, that had this a similar kind of effect on me.
We have to at least mention this because it's probably the thought that most people would come to when this question was asked of them. When Ares died in Final Fantasy VII, I mean, I'm not a huge Final Fantasy fan, never have been, but at the time when I was about, what, maybe 14 or so when that game came out, when that happened, I was so shocked that something like that could happen in a game because there was almost no precedent for something like that. I mean, it's happened, of course, in the past, but in that particular game, that was the, you know, it was like the psycho twist where the main character gets killed halfway through the story. That's a, you know, such an impactful, important character that got cut down a third of the way through the game, such a violent way. Sure, so your character, Cloud, basically meets two women during the game. One's his ally, and one is this innocent flower girl that he kind of saves a few times, and she joins his party. And the villain of the story kidnaps her, I believe. I haven't played it in a decade, so if I'm a little foggy on this, I'm sorry. But anyway, she gets into the villain's hands, and Cloud goes to save her. And right before he can, the villain drives his giant sword through her stomach, and she falls into a water and dies. And there's nothing you can do. And, of course, at the time, because we were living in the pre-internet days, there was rumors that people, you know, there was a way to save her if you did this certain thing, or people were trying desperately to find a way to save this character, and there was not a way to do it. It's impossible. So that was such a big, huge twist at a time when games really weren't trying something like that. And it was very, it's pretty much the most defining moment of that game. And it still, to this day, is very powerful. So that would be my pick.
It's interesting, because I'm fairly certain, but I don't want to stand by it, that that's not the first time in the Final Fantasy series that one of your party's characters could die, but it was the one that everyone picked up on. It's whether that's to do with, you know, Final Fantasy VII gaining a whole new audience on the PlayStation and it being in the, you know, the cinematic, the 3D cinematic, and being quite so, because it was a really, for its time, a really good cutscene. I can remember it now, and it was it had a similar effect on me, but I don't know. I feel like sometimes with Final Fantasy VII story, people have rose-tinted view on it, that it was this epic, wonderful story when really, I don't know, it was good for its time, maybe, sure, in terms of gaming narrative, but it doesn't stand up well.
I mean, from my angle, I had never been interested in an RPG, and that was the one that pulled me in. So I'm sure a lot of people are like me, too, that when they saw Final Fantasy VII, they had to play it regardless of whether or not they had cared about RPGs before. And I think that's why that one still holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts.
No, I totally agree. And I do have it on my list, actually. So, you know, for all what I'm saying, it was one of the ones I'd have chosen.
It's interesting you bring up that idea that people were looking up on the internet. There was kind of rumors that you could save her. It's that thing with gaming, right? There's this idea that maybe there's something you could do, whereas if you were watching a movie and the character died, that, you know, that's it. Whereas, you know, it's so shocking in the game because you feel like maybe you had some control over it.
Right. We have control over so many aspects of the game. You just want to take control and pretty much make it the story that you want it to be. But there are certain times that, you know, they won't let you do that.
Is there not also an element of something being taken away from your control? Because, you know, Aerith was a character you could control, and it's almost like it's limiting what the player has in their arsenal. And I don't know, that's a bit of an emotional way of looking at it, but that's something that came to mind when I played it.
There's definitely like a utility aspect to that comes into play. I'm sure we'll talk about that later too. It's just, you know, people killing off characters because they have something that the player wants, or, you know, totally not really being emotionally invested and just looking at it from the practical standpoint of finishing the game.
Sure. The one I had on my list was from Call of Duty 4 with the nuclear blast halfway through the game, and that your American soldier character being caught up in it. And I'm not naive. I appreciate that Call of Duty doesn't necessarily do its narrative that well. But it just, for me, it was a really interesting dichotomy, because I really dislike how that game handles death in its gameplay. It provides you with those quotes, those war quotes, and that always just seems very strange and disconnected and patronizing to me. And then all of a sudden it has this really shocking moment, and I was completely caught unawares by it, and it really changed the whole landscape of that game for me, and I really became immersed in it after that. And I don't know whether either of you played that game and had a similar kind of viewpoint on it.
Well, I did not, so I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to here.
What happened was, there's a scene in when your soldier's in the Middle Eastern country, which is not Iraq, but whatever. So he's...
It's about halfway through the game also, just wanted to get that out.
It's halfway through the game, and maybe I'm getting this wrong as well, I can't quite remember, but I believe that he's just about to be taken away from it. There's a helicopter that's come to essentially take him away and bring him back home, and just as he boards on the helicopter, there's a blast in the distance, and it's a nuclear bomb, and it sweeps up towards the camera really, really quickly, and then it blacks out, and then you return to your character, and he's limping around in the desolation after the bomb, and I don't know how he quite survived it, but in any case, it provides this really good moment where he's looking around, there's people dead everywhere, and just after a while, he collapses and presumably dies, and then you return to your other character, the British soldier who you've been controlling throughout the game. And like I said, it just caught me off guard. Did you play it, Joe?
Yeah, I've always played Call of Duties, but that one in particular, they did some really crazy, interesting things. I mean, you know, first-person shooters, it's kind of hard to really, you know, get attached to your character because you never see them. They don't really have that much impact on, like, the story or anything. It's always just things are happening in front of you and you're running through it. But with Call of Duty, they really tried to humanize those characters and say, hey, you know, this is a real person and he might not make it. They off that character in such a brutal and shocking way. I mean, especially after the previous couple levels, you were fighting to keep that character alive and get him to the point that he needed to be. And you get on the chopper, and, you know, every other game would have faded to black at that point. But to see the aftermath, and then to brutally show this character crawling away, trying to, you know, grasp any last piece of life that he has left in him, crawling away from this chopper, looking at a destroyed city in front of him, and then presumably dying, it brought that game to a whole new, another level of storytelling in an FPS, which, you know, for the most part, FPSs don't really try and tell interesting stories. Don't try to get you to care for the characters, but it's hard not to care for this guy after, you know, he survives so much and then meets such a brutal end.
Well, I don't know if I totally agree with that. I mean, you know, first-person shooters, they don't do a great job of telling the story of the player that you're playing as, but they do a pretty good job with the characters around the player, because you see them firsthand and, you know, you're interacting with them. I think that's definitely the case with BioShock, and I think to a certain extent some of the Half-Life games as well.
I actually think with the Half-Life games, it's a big thing with, you know, especially in the second game in episode 1 and 2 of Alex and how she interacts with the player character. But I guess I think that's how it works in Call of Duty 4, especially with the British soldier, you know, the interaction he had with the British major, and that was really good. But something that came to mind as well, Call of Duty 4, I don't know if you remember, Joe, the introduction as well, where it has like a Half-Life introduction where, you know, you're just being whisked and you've got control of the camera and you're being taken through on rails almost, and you're put into the viewpoint of the Prime Minister of the country, who's been kidnapped and is being taken on his way to be executed publicly. And so all you can do is look around you and see all the chaos going on in this country, and then you're taken to this big arena in front of the public, in front of this baying crowd, and a guy takes a gun, puts it in front of you, so basically the barrel of the gun is down the line of the camera and shoots you. And it's not quite obviously a player character death, but I thought it was really impactful. It was a really strong way of starting a game, and I'd like to see more games doing that with death, but that's a whole other matter.
You know, last week we talked about how death has been used as a mechanic to game designers, and how death can be used to get a player to a certain place, get a player to feel a certain thing, get a player to do certain things a certain way, so that the game gets played the way that the designers wish you to play it. So this week we're going to talk about how death can be used as a storytelling mechanic, how within a narrative, death can be presented in a way that is both impactful and fits the story that they're trying to tell. So, you know, and death is a particularly interesting topic to bring in because death kind of affects everyone the same way in the world. I mean, everyone has to deal with death at some point. Everyone has the same feelings about death for the most part. So so the way that death is used in certain games can bring the experience to a whole nother level if it's done right, and that's what I kind of want to go into. So assuming that a game strives to have a decent narrative, like the games that we mentioned so far, I'm not talking about games like Tool Rock or anything along those lines, what function can death serve in a game story? What are the advantages or disadvantages of implementing an impactful death into the middle of a narrative?
Well, I think it's I think it's like any medium, and it's kind of like what you were saying before. It's pretty universally understood what death is. It impacts not just the person that dies, but the people around them. So it's like a book or a movie. It's a way to draw out some emotional impact from the person who's experiencing it.
I would echo a lot of what Jared said. I think obviously what's interesting with what separates the medium from other mediums obviously is interactivity, and I guess that's what we're going to get onto in this show, and how the interactivity element of video games affects our experience with death in video games.
You know, since we are talking about an interactive medium, the developers have to set certain preset ideas, preset moments in the game to get to. So the player has to, you know, complete control over the character for the most part until a certain point at which control is taken away and something happens. So they use death in these situations that can bring the players to a more, you know, involved level than otherwise. I mean, would they not done that? Because, you know, as I said, death does get very, does bring people in, does impact everyone equally. And so I figured we'd talk about a couple of games that have handled death correctly. Obviously, this is a fairly short list because a lot of games don't really try to do anything too crazy with their storylines. So I was wondering if you guys think of any games that handled death correctly in the context of the story that they were trying to tell, and they also executed it well, much like the ones we had already mentioned.
Well, yeah, I kind of agree with your thought that a lot of games don't handle death that well. I kind of think that, you know, even some of the examples that we're talking about where it just happens through a cutscene and you don't really have any control over it is kind of a broken model. I mean, it can be emotionally stirring. For me, it's not that much. I kind of prefer games that, you know, that do it in the gameplay, you know, so to speak. And I got these examples. I think I've written about them before, but you know, one good example is Passage, that little indie artsy game. It's just a 5-minute game, but you know, you play through and it's kind of a little life cycle thing, and you always die at the end. That's the point of the game, is that it's what you do in the middle, and the game always ends with your death. So it's kind of using it in a different way to say something different than just being kind of a consequence of failure or just a emotional thing that's thrown at the player in hopes of drawing out a few tears.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, Passage is a really interesting case. That was an indie game, right? It was released as part of the... Was it an IGF finalist?
It was part of some contest that the point of the game was... The point of this contest was to create a game that uses a weird aspect ratio. And I don't know, maybe it got into IGF later, but the game is like, you know, 256 pixels long, the frame window, and it's very short as well, so it's kind of like a strip that you're walking along. And so the character's walking along, and so it's looking for treasures along the way, and you can meet a woman along the way and go along this sort of area together. And as you're going, the background is getting hazier, and you're sort of moving forward in the play screen, and then all of a sudden you just a gravestone appears, and that's it, and you've died. And you know, you can kind of play it again and experience it in different ways, but the death is always the end.
If I'm right, just is that the one also where it's going through the seven stages of life? Is that the right video game as well? So it's, you know, like you're saying, where you meet the woman, is that marriage, and do you have a child along the way? Is that right?
No, it doesn't do a lot in terms of the whole life cycle. You kind of start the game as a sort of a young person, you know, a young adult, and then you end up an old man. But aside from meeting a woman, there's no other, you know, life cycle stuff. There's no bar mitzvah or anything like that.
What a shame.
Yeah.
That sounds really interesting. And I mean, we talked a lot about how the indie scene is one of, you know, on the forefront of producing these great abstract takes on gaming and gaming conventions. And I think what I'm referring to, and I'm sure listeners are screaming at me what it is, and there's a game which goes through these seven life cycles and, again, inevitably ends up with death, and that sounded really interesting to me.
One of the ones I wanted to actually bring out that I thought with death particularly well was Heavenly Sword, the Sony PS3 game from a couple of years ago. Have you guys played through that one?
I have not.
I have.
Okay, so basically it's a God of War clone type thing. You play as this character named Noriko, and she has this sword that I believe when she touches it, they tell you that it will kill her eventually. If she keeps using it and powers it up, it will kill her. They tell you this in the beginning of the game. But because it's a third-person action-adventure game on a major console made by a major studio, you assume that everything is going to be fine and dandy in the end, and the villain will meet an ultimate end while the hero walks away into the sunset. But at the end of the game, Noriko ends up getting killed right after she vanquishes the final boss, and actually dying, she just dies. And it's done in such a way that, to preface this, the game uses this motion capture technology. It really, every character has very expressive emotions in that game. Their faces show every single thing that they're feeling. They do it very well, pretty much better than most games that I've ever seen. And at the end, when she does fall and she is on knocking at death's door, it's both a shock and a real gut punch to see what's transpiring, because I mean, here's a character, you expect her to be the next Kratos, you know, the next character that's going to be back in 2 years in an all new game, and an interesting character that I would have loved to have seen again in another game. But as she's dying and you're watching this happen, you're both shocked and in awe that they actually had the guts to do this, to kill a major character in a major action title for a major console. And the way it's done is very beautiful, very, very nicely presented, and it fits the story perfectly. And it's honestly one of the better examples that I would use of death being handled very well, narratively speaking, in a video game. And before anyone asks, no, there is no way to save her.
I mean, I played that game, and I agree about the strength of the character. She was a very good character. But going to what Jared says, that's no different in terms of doing something different with death. I think I completely agree with you. It was a shock, but as Jared's saying, you know, it was a cut scene. It was a cinematic presentation. It didn't do anything necessarily different. And the other thing, the story wasn't all that good in that game, and the game wasn't all that good. And my thought when I saw her die was not, oh, what a shame she's died. My thought was, okay, you've killed off the best thing about your game. So I found myself shaking my head at Sony, which I was doing a lot during the PS3's first year, but it didn't impact. I was shocked, but more shocked that they were willing to throw away such a marketable character.
Right, and Joe, do you feel like the death of that character, did it mean anything, or was it just, you know, raw emotion? You know, when at the end of the day, is it just something that pulls on your heartstrings? Does it really change the way you think about anything? Is it really profound at all? Is it my inclination
no.
is that it wouldn't be.
As Sinan said, the story in that game wasn't that great. I think the cutscenes were presented very well because, as I said, they did this weird motion capture thing with the people's faces that brought a lot of character emotions. Like, you could actually see how the characters were feeling just based on their expressions alone, which you can't really say for many games. So, I mean, I thought it was presented well. I thought that it was well acted. I thought everything was great. But in the end, it didn't change my opinion of the game, which was that it was a fairly good but kind of average action-adventure title, and it really didn't affect me more to the... It was more of a shock, let's put it that way. It was more of a shock than it was a profound emotional experience that changed the way that I look at games. But because they did have the guts to do it, whereas no other major third-person action-adventure game, to my knowledge, has done something like that, I think it's at least worth mentioning in that they tried to use death in a way that would impact the player, and I think it did, in that particular case, impact all who played it.
I think that's a fair point. When thinking about what Jared said and taking it further, and I guess, again, we say the indie game is always in the forefront of doing crazy ideas, and then there's Hideo Kojima, who's always experimenting with his games. And immediately when we were discussing this topic, organizing this show, two games came to mind, and that was Metal Gear Solid 3 and Metal Gear Solid 4. And with Metal Gear Solid 3, it's not the player character dying or anything, it's the moment. I don't know if you've both played that game, but I'll explain it anyway. You've been going through the whole game trying to track down an old mentor called the boss, and eventually you are in a standoff with her and defeat her, and the game then presents you with this scene where you are in control of Snake, and all you have to do is press X to shoot and kill the boss. And, you know, the camera will just rotate in this sort of quite peaceful scene, just waiting for you to pull the trigger. And it was surprisingly heartbreaking. It was like all of a sudden as if the burden was on my shoulders to end it. Really put quite a lot of gravity on that death, especially knowing what I knew in the back of my head and was revealed later on that she obviously wasn't the guilty party and was sacrificing herself for the greater good. And I thought that was a really good way of handling death. Did either of you play that game, and what did you think if you did?
Well, I haven't. It makes me think of another example, but Joe, if you want to talk about that specifically first, then, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just say briefly, I played the game, and I absolutely agree. The Metal Gear Solid 3, I think, came the closest of all the Metal Gear games to really making a point and trying to, you know, involve the player into the story that they were trying to tell. I would say way more so than 4 did. And I think that particular... I mean, I love the story, and I thought that the ending, especially the fact that they made you do that, you pull the trigger with the X button, as you mentioned, that was very intricate to the experience and very good. But I read that a lot of people think that that's the finest moment in the series, and the fact that you had to kill this character was heartbreaking. And they did bring this character back and forth as far as a memory. She was talked about a lot during that game, so they, you know, obviously it struck a chord with a lot of the Metal Gear fans to the point where they had to, you know, make her also a part of the sequel and bring her back for the people that wanted a little bit more closure in that story.
Right. So what was the example you were thinking of, Jared?
Well, and this is good because I'm pretty sure you guys have both played Mad World, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So the end of the game is you're sort of confronting this guy who's, I guess he masterminded the whole thing, or he had some big involvement. And so, you know, the conclusion of the game, you're asked to sort of kill this guy in a particularly gruesome manner, much consistent with the rest of the game. And it's, you know, it's also a similar situation in which you're just standing there and the game is waiting for you to pull the trigger. and there's not really anything you can do about it. It just waits for you to do that. And I tried. I just kind of sat there. But, you know, it wants you to sort of take part in that bloodlust that kind of drives the whole game. I'm wondering how you guys feel about that mechanic where you have to press a button, but you don't have any say in the matter. And this in turn, you know, kills the character.
Well, for me with Metal Gear Solid 3, why I think it was so fantastic, because it was right at the end of the game, just like with Mad World, and it makes you examine just what you've been doing for the whole course of the game. And of course, Metal Gear Solid games are quite long, and there's quite a lot of violence involved, not obviously nearly as much as Mad World, but it is a way of all of a sudden putting the spotlight on the player and asking him to really consider what he's doing and how trivialized death is in video games. With Mad World, though, I don't know what Joe would say. I'll let Joe speak first, but it didn't have anywhere near the same impact for me. What did you think, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 5 previous hours of throwing people off giant pinball bongs and watching them fly all over the place, I think that kind of, you know, wore me down as far as seeing that that, you know, the type of thing happen. But I like the idea. I like the fact that, you know, a video game is supposed to be an interactive medium, and you know, we should be put into that kind of position more often, where, you know, we have to pull the trigger, not some non-interactive thing that is completely out of our hands. And I think that kind of thing could be done more. And in fact, what I wanted to talk about a little bit was how, you know, I think more interactivity should be put into the narratives in this regard. I think that, you know, while Mad World might have, you know, pulled itself out of the running for, you know, having a well-done, very impactful ending like that, I think that kind of thing should be used way more often than it is.
What would you think if instead of, you know, pressing the button and that's it, you had a choice whether or not to pull the trigger?
In another game, yes.
Yes, exactly.
In that game, I was thinking, you know what, I got a kind, it was more like a crowning glory, really, that game, because all of it was just about being so over the top with your violence and really getting into the Wiimote movement. So yeah. I didn't see it the same way. But in another, you know, say if Metal Gear Solid 3, for example, if I'd been given a choice, I don't know whether that would have worked. I think not, maybe not in that version either, because I think it was important that you kill the character off for the linear story. But again, I immediately start thinking of Grand Theft Auto 4 and choices about death, and a lot of games don't handle it very well at all.
Well, I mean, but if you look at, like, Bioshock, the way that handled, I know it was way more involved into the actual gameplay in that game, but, I mean, Bioshock gave you the choice of killing these characters or keeping them alive, and that profoundly affected, for the most part, the story in the actual game. I mean, do you think that kind of thing would be better, where it's more of a central mechanic to the game rather than just a quick choice at the end that sets you down path A or path B?
With Bioshock, again, there's another problem, and it's... I quickly worked it out, and again, this is my unemotional way of playing video games. I quickly worked out that if I didn't harvest them, I would be better off in the long run. So I unemotionally thought, well, I'll save them. And, you know, I'll admit, when my girlfriend played it, she couldn't bear to harvest them. So it works for some people. For me, who's hardened and soulless, it didn't work at all.
It makes me think of, I think, what a bigger gripe that I have is the lack of gray area. You know, a lot of times when games are proposing these moral choices that have to do with life and death, it's, you know, it's very black and white, and that's what life and death is. But, you know, it kind of gets in the way of things. You know, it's, you either kill the character or you don't. And I think that can be a problem too with what Sinan was talking about, with you know, acting in the best interest of yourself as a player. You know, when you have a black and white choice, that's very easy to do. But when you're dealing with something that would be more, well, you know, can I kill him? Do I just walk away? I don't know. I don't know how this would be proposed in a game that, you know, we have these very traditional ways of thinking about games. But, you know, maybe a game could have a broader range of choices than, you know, life or death scenarios.
Well, I think Fallout 3 kind of had a gray area for the most part. I mean, yes, a lot of the choices in that game were A or B. You kill someone or you let them live, that type of thing. But there were also, like, a bunch of smaller choices that kind of affected the way the game went. Like, you know, like there were certain areas where you could push a button that would blow up a town, or you could, you know, let the, disarm the bomb and then the town's okay. Or you could, you know, not push the button, but totally tell everyone in the town, hey, if you don't give me all your money, I'm going to just push the button and then you guys are going to die. So, I mean, you're still being a scumbag, but you're also not being the ultimate scumbag and pushing that button, killing everybody and you know, leaving everyone for dead. So I think, you know, with that game in particular, there's a lot of little choices that would, you know, not be good, not be bad, but would kind of just be a little bit of both that led to some interesting gameplay points during the game.
It's interesting that you mention that, because so much of my views in terms of the whole death issue in Fallout 3 pertains to the ending, but I guess it is a pretty good point about, you know, what you do during the game. In games like that, I always try to be the good guy, and I'm not really sure why. I don't really take that much pleasure in being the evil guy, but, you know, I have the really good karma, and every time I went to Megaton, some character would come up to me and be like, here's some bullets, or here's a med kit or something, just for being a really awesome person. And it's like, I like those kind of things. I guess I didn't really think about it before, but now it's like, that's kind of what I like to see, kind of the world changes a little bit in response to how you act, as opposed to just, you know, you're being the good guy or bad guy, and the world is, you know, great or in eternal darkness.
Sure. I think with sandbox games, they are getting closer to introducing, as you're both saying, this gray area. And, you know, I'm like you, Jared, actually. I played Fallout 3 completely good, and regards that person who kept giving you stuff whenever you went to Megaton, it got completely annoying towards the end of the game, but, you know, it's kind of like, leave me alone. But I was thinking of Fable 2, and this is not necessarily related to death, but it's related at least to morality, and there are quite a lot of these big, like Joe is saying, big good or be bad decisions, but there are all a lot of smaller ones as well, and it's those smaller ones which seem to segregate certain people into whether they like you or not. So when I went into one of the towns, that, you know, 95% of the people liked me, but there was this one guy who just couldn't stand me, and really, I don't know what I'd done to piss him off so much, but he really didn't like what I'd done, who I was and what I was doing. So I'm with both of you. I like to see that grey area put into games, but I think with sandbox games it's easy. With linear games, I'm not sure it's so simple.
It's too bad that Fallout 3 kind of ended the way it did, I think, in light of that you can have these real shades of gray in your character, you know, but in the end all it is either, you know, it's basically three things, right? You either sacrifice yourself to save humanity, you have somebody else sacrifice themselves to save humanity, and then also you may or may not have poisoned all the mutants.
Yeah, especially when as the new DLC has come out and introduced these new options, and with regards to, I believe, the mutant who is going around with you being able to, you know, save everyone if he wanted to, and that option not being there. So, yeah, Fallout 3 ending was a bit disappointing in that regard. I want to get to your article, Jared, where you focused a lot on how video games, through their, you know, conventions of death, trivialize it, and I wanted to sort of go further with that. Do you think that there are significant strides being made to try and examine this, or, you know, with the way that we were talking about deathless games last week, or do you think that still the conventions of failure and punishment are still too present in video games?
I think not really. I mean, we've definitely seen a lot of examples where they try to come up with an explanation for why you fail and die, but still come back and keep fighting. You know, there's obviously Prince of Persia, where you just are perpetually saved. There's the Darkness, where you die and the character, the demon character that's possessing you, you know, says it's not your time to die yet, and kind of spits you back into the real world. And then there's the Vita Chambers in Bioshock, but that doesn't leave me totally satisfied, you know, because it's just, it's kind of like a rationalization, but it's not really a fundamental change in what games are, which is this sort of life or death struggle.
I guess the one thing that when I was reading your article that immediately came to mind was about how we see gaming as an escapist medium. And what I wanted to ask you is, do you think it's important that we have something in real life that we're afraid of, that it scares us, that it's, you know, it's, some people find very depressing to think about. Do you think it's important that it's in a medium which we associate with, you know, fantasy, escapism, and essentially it's in many ways still about having fun?
Well, I guess it kind of depends what you want out of the medium, right? It's like if that's all you're looking for, then it's fine. And I certainly have no problem with these kind of games where you're just, you know, it's a classic shoot 'em up. You're trying not to die and you're trying to kill as many people as possible. You know, I'm okay with that kind of game, but it's limiting. You know, I think that was what I was trying to say with the article. And, you know, it just kind of limits what you can do with games to keep putting players in these life or death situations. So that's why I brought up those examples of indie games that kind of approached it from a completely different way. It just kind of changes the way that you think about games. And another example that came up since then was Braid. And you guys, you know, maybe you want to talk about Braid, because that's definitely a good example of handling death in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we went over last week a lot of games that have kind of found ways to work around death, as Jared was talking about. And the way Braid handled it, I mean, the fact that you could just kind of rewind and completely erase the fact that it happened is definitely interesting. And I think in that game it fit perfectly because, mechanically speaking, that game would have been incredibly frustrating had you had to worry about death and all those the things that come along with it. But just as how fitting it is to the experience, the way that the rewind mechanic both, you know, worked as a puzzle-solving tool, as a narrative angle, and as a, you know, solvent for the problem of death was perfectly fitting that type of game, the experience that they were trying to provide, Jonathan Blow was trying to spread to the masses. And, you know, I think that kind of thing is okay. I think that it has to fit the game. It has to, the deathless game, the idea of no fear of anything, that has to fit the type of game that they're going for. I think Braided perfectly fits. I think Prince of Persia, for the most part, it fit. But I think each game has to kind of be judged on its own, has to be thought about and carefully considered to whether or not this game, this type of game, can utilize this mechanic, this deathless mechanic. And I think as long as that is carefully considered and thought out and planned out nicely, then you know, that's fine.
The thing is with Braid, as with Passage, which we were talking about earlier, is that death is meaningful in those games. You know, Braid, when you die, you can rewind, and that's saying something about, you know, the theme of the game, which is this whole idea of, you know, what happens if you can just turn back time and correct everything. So it's a statement. It's not just a consequence that you face because you messed something up. It says something about what the game itself is trying to say.
I would totally agree, and I think that's emphasized by the animation the player character Tim goes through when he dies. He has this look of pained anguish, and it's not the same as in, you know, you've been hurt. It's quite clearly regret.
I think I need a bigger TV because I didn't see that, but I definitely should. I will look closer because that sounds really awesome.
Well, I think if he clutches his heart, which is what made me think about it. I'm not sure if I'm wrong about that. Maybe again, I'm remembering.
It does seem familiar, though. No, I'm going to look at that.
I never noticed that at all. Wow.
I'm worried now. I'm going to get called out on this.
yeah, Joe, you can call him out next week.
I absolutely will.
So, one of the interesting things me and Joe were talking about when we were organizing the show was about a player character dying permanently in a game, and we were talking about Heavy Rain, which I don't know if you know much about, Jared.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Sure, so Heavy Rain is the next game from Quantic Dream, they're the guys who made Indigo Prophecy. I don't know if you played that one, Jared.
I'm familiar with it, but I haven't played it, actually.
I believe it's kind of like an adventure game. I'm pretty sure there's no real action in it, but it's a series. You move the character around, explore the environments, and there's like quick time event style gameplay moments where if you fail at these quick time event moments, which would be action type sequences, instead of just getting hurt or retrying the segment, your character can actually get killed. And the story of that game is that there's a serial killer around, and failing at one of the quick time event moments means that the serial killer actually kills your character, and then that's it. And what happens at that point is the camera then switches over to the next character, and you follow through their life until, again, you're faced with these quick time event moments. If you successfully complete it, your character lives. If not, your character dies, and your control gets moved to a different character. So in that game, every sequence that you play through becomes very important because it changes the entire rest of the game and the way that things pan out. And they say, I forget how many different strings that the strands that the storyline can go in, but I know for a fact that there are dozens of different outcomes and endings that you can possibly see in this game. So you can play it multiple times, see totally different things, and to basically control the fates of every single character that you control. And once they are dead, they are dead. That's it. It is permadeath. That's an end.
It's a tricky thing, right? Because as a gamer, your impulse, what you really want when you're playing games, is to see the ideal outcome, right? That's kind of what we all want. We want to win. So it's hard to have a game where, failure is permanent and there's nothing else you can do about it, because you want to see all the different ways of how the game could play out. You basically you have to fail at some point.
Right. I think it's interesting in terms of attachment with the character, and this is why I think Heavy Rain is going to come under close scrutiny, is how well it can build up these attachments with each of these player characters. And it's such a cinematic game that I'm not sure it's gonna struggle, I think, in terms of maybe necessarily imposing players onto these characters, which, like we said, first person shooters do a good job of because of the way characters react to you. But I am interested by it, and I think it's doing a lot of exciting things, and I can't wait to play it. But I agree with you, Jared, that if most players, if they have the option to, they will reverse a failure, and they will look for the most positive outcome, and that makes that again trivializes death to some extent.
The difference in that game between working as a story, working in implementing all these different strands of lines of stories that you could possibly follow, and actually being a solid game, I think that's where the problem is going to be with that game, is whether or not the actual gameplay in that will be worth playing through dozens of times to see these outcomes, or if it's more just going to be a choose your own adventure novel where you kind of just watching all these deaths don't really mean much to you because there are so many of them, and because you can literally change the story like that. Whether or not they implement that as a solid game is where I think that game is going to falter.
Something that's come to mind, which I think we were talking about when we really first organized the show, is say with Fallout 3 and its ending and that choice you had, what if there was a possibility that after you died, you could become another character? So if you could sacrifice yourself in that last area, do the right thing, but you'd be transported into another character. So in that case, you've got this, you're doing the right thing, but you're losing out for it, or you can keep your character but do the wrong thing. I'd have thought that would have been really interesting with that game.
So you'd be, if you kept your character, you'd possess all your skills and everything that the possessions and everything like that, but if not, you'd basically have to start from the ground up. Is that kind of the scenario you're thinking of?
Absolutely. I mean, maybe not necessarily regards... Yeah, I think you'd probably have to do it in terms of skill and resources and things like that. But more importantly, you'd lose this character you'd been playing as for 30-plus hours and suddenly thrown right, new person, enjoy, make another story. And I just wonder if that, again, adds that kind of grey area you were talking about to the decision, because it's not, neither decision is totally one way or the other.
Yeah, I think that'd be an interesting name. I don't know if for Fallout 3, just simply because, that's something that happens at the end of the game, so kind of the opportunity to experience the repercussions isn't really there. But it's a model that would be interesting, definitely. The idea that maybe you can keep all of your possessions and kind of live on, but maybe the world will be harder for you, you know, thereafter. Or you can kind of sacrifice yourself and be someone else and experience a better world, you know. I think that'd be definitely an interesting choice to present players with.
Or yeah. Even in Mass Effect, if you had been able to kill Shepard at the end of the game, because in Mass Effect 2, you're going to be able to pick up your character exactly where you left off. So it wouldn't have affected you in Mass Effect 1, but you know, choosing to sacrifice yourself at the end of that game would have definitely affected your playthrough of the sequel, so that might have been an interesting way to go.
So we've talked a lot about certain games which handle it well and some of the ideas that we have maybe for ways that death could be handled differently, and I wanted to get on to some of the more divisive games, and we've touched on Grand Theft Auto 4, but you know, that a lot of people think that it did a lot of good work with its moral decisions, and a lot of people disagree, and I'm guessing, Jared, that you're on the disagreeing side of
the coin. I actually didn't get far enough. It got to a point in the game where it froze up on me, and I haven't picked it back up again, so I'm not sure what part you're talking about. I mean, I know there were some decisions with killing characters early in the game, but I'm assuming you're talking about something later on.
I'm not a huge fan of GTA 4, so I'm just going to try this as good as I can. There was two characters. One, they're both pretty bad dudes. One was like this old school gangster who's had a really tough time in previous years, and he's trying to build himself back up as a current day, you know, gangster and get a lot of money and get himself back into a position where he could, you know, get himself back on top. And there's this other guy, really annoying character that you know, is on top right now, but he doesn't belong there. He's kind of a douche. And you're given the opportunity to kill one or the other. I think the rewards are greater if you kill the old school guy, but obviously you hate this current day successful character so much, and you have to choose.
Oh, I think I know which one you're talking about. Is it the guy? This is the one guy comes out of prison.
Yeah.
And the yes. other guy is like he's got an afro and he's like living in Northwood. That guy.
That's
something
right.
like that. Yeah.
Something like that. I just remember because I used to live in the inspiration for that area. So that's what Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about though, and I think I killed the gangster that was at the top and sympathized with the guy coming out of jail because he seemed more like a he seemed more like a realistic person to me, and I guess I sympathized with him.
Yeah, I mean I remember listening to Patrick Klepek talking about this a while back. Patrick Klepek now with G4 TV, and he picked the guy at the top to save and the guy who'd come out of prison to kill. And he said that he realized later that he'd made the wrong decision and really regretted it. And I thought, okay, that's quite interesting. But then as I thought about it more, I came to the conclusion, which I guess you were talking about earlier, Jared, that there was this clearly signposted good option and clearly signposted bad option. And I'm not sure quite how he necessarily went to the one way or the other. And I just think it would have been more interesting if it was really, there wasn't much to go on. But then again, it would almost seem pointless in that respect. Like, why would you have to kill one or two people when there isn't much to go on with the choice? That's why I think these decisions are flawed in their concept, because really, it's not realistic at the end of the day.
Right, and we keep coming back to this. It's what you put your own best interests forward as a player, not as a character in the story, and that just it always gets in the way of trying to have some sort of emotional impact. Is this idea that, you know, you're making things harder for yourself in the game, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe you know they're trying to shed some light on, you know, yourself being a selfish person or something, and now that's what they want out of you, but I don't know. I think I agree. It can seem a little canned, you know, and players do have that inclination to look after themselves.
Right. Yeah, I agree totally. And I think one of the games that, for me, Dead Space, the way that game ended and the way that I envisioned it ending were two completely different things, and the way that it ended left me completely unsatisfied. And I think this is one of the ways that, I mean, even though it is a predetermined choice, I think had they thrown something like this in, it would have been more interesting. So let me just go into what I was thinking with that game. So in the end of Dead Space, your character fights this big giant alien creature thing, even though everyone else has died, and his wife, who is the sole purpose that he went to this particular area, his wife is dead. He finds this out late in the game. And so the only thing he has left pretty much is his own life. He gets onto this escape shuttle as the aliens are trying to get him. And he escapes off into the space, and once he's up there, the ghost of his wife attacks him and kills him on the ship. And that's how the game ends. And it's completely ridiculous and very unsatisfying. And that game made me think real hard about how death is handled in games and how a choice there would have been more interesting. How had they given me the choice of saying, hey, well, you can either get on this escape pod and get yourself off into space and save your character's life, or you can go back down into the ship and all these aliens that are still running around, you could take a bomb down to the middle of the ship, blow it up, kill yourself, but kill everything that you've been fighting in the whole game and make a point, make your life meaningful. And I think had they actually given you that kind of option, the game would have been far more interesting in the later moments. And I think those are the kind of options that I would like to see, something that makes the player have to think of what they want. Do they want to be satisfied at the end of this game, or do they want this guy to live? And I think it's interesting, and I think more games should do it, and I think that it would give you feel a little bit more organic than the canned, predetermined outcomes that most games have, where fairly predictable hero gets out at the last moment and everything is fine. So that's the kind of stuff I'm looking for in games.
I kind of disagree, and I with the that outcome that you're envisioning, and I don't know. This is kind of me being sort of unconvinced of my own argument, because I know what I would do in that situation, which is, I would save at a point where I could go and experience both endings, and then I would go and see what happened, just so I could find out, what two situations I get myself into, And I don't think I really like that, because it doesn't leave you with anything. It's just you're kind of off there, and you don't really have any closure, because there's just two completely different possibilities. It's hard. Once I start thinking about the situation of, okay, well, I'm not big fan of the way that death is handled in games, and then I think to myself, well, okay, well, what would be better? And that's where I sort of get stuck, because we have a lot of conventions in video games that we fall back on, and one of them is just this idea of a linear plot that is that is determined by you being successful. And that's what games are in a lot of situations, and it's hard to get away from that. So it's tough to look at one particular game and be like, well, maybe we could just handle that, a little bit differently in terms of the plot.
With that particular concept of, gamers wanting to experience every single ending, and I know you're not the only one in that regard, there's no way that you can design a game to prevent that, because even if you say... if you choose one ending, you can't go back to that save point and experience the other. We now live in the Web 2.0 age, and you just have to go onto YouTube and find the ending if you want to. So there's no way that'll ever be quashed.
That's what I did for Fallout 3. I went right onto YouTube and looked at all the other Fallout 3 endings so I could see what they were.
There you go. To come back then to Joe's point about Dead Space in particular, I wouldn't want to see the choice in that regard. I think it was fine as a linear game, as a linear story. I disagreed with the death because in some ways it cheapened the whole experience, in that it was a really cheesy horror movie death. It was dissonant in that the rest of the game you made this struggle and it didn't feel cheesy. It felt quite mature, and then all of a sudden, oh look, booger booger behind the chair, here's the monster. I just think it was a poor narrative choice, and a lot of games are guilty of that.
To go back to what Jared was saying, Silent Hill 2 did kind of the come up with a solution for what you were saying of how, you could just go back to the specific point where you have to make the A or B decision and you could watch both endings. Of course you could still look on YouTube, but let's just ignore that for right now. So in Silent Hill 2, there are four, five, six different endings, something like that. but instead of just being a point A, point B decision, the decision is actually the entire game. So what happens is you have this companion during the entire game, and if you let her get injured, if you let her get hit by enemies, if she gets, you know, hurt in any way, something in the game clicks, and it starts keeping track of how you've been treating this character. Have you shot her yourself accidentally? Have you been watching her? Have you let her catch up to you when she was running behind you? Or did you just run away and, you know, whatever happens to her happens to her? And depending on how you treat this character is what ending you get. And so there's really no way to go back and just, you know, click a button and have everything changed the other way. You have to play through the game again and do things completely differently to produce the other ending that you want to see. And there's a couple other factors during the game. It's not just that one thing. You have to, you know, be a certain place at a certain time. You have to push a certain button that you wouldn't think to push. There's a couple of different triggers, but there's no clear way in that game to get the certain ending that you want to come out. There's no like A or B decision. It's instead a whole, it takes everything that you're doing into account and then delivers to you what ending it thinks that you should have. And while this isn't necessarily, you know, a big evolutionary step from the A and B decision, it at least kind of tries to make the ending that you get fit the way you are playing a little bit more than just the choice that we were talking about before. And I think that was an interesting way of doing it, if not a frustrating way of doing it, because you really can't guarantee an ending when you play through a game again. But at least they tried to deliver something differently than most other games.
I think what I kind of like more, I definitely like that idea, and I think what I would kind of like more, and we were talking about this earlier with Fallout, is, you know, to have the whole world change in the game, you know, not just the ending you get, you know, because games are so good at modeling worlds, aren't they? So to change the whole environment and to be able to get feedback instead of just seeing a different cutscene, is that, I think, is like the most meaningful outcome you can produce.
Totally. I think what we're kind of getting at here is the difference between linear and sandbox games, and specifically relating to Def, to see linear games handle it, it's always divisive and it's difficult and it's hard necessarily to maybe get too attached, and it's, you know, there are some rare moments when we do, and for a lot of people, it was Final Fantasy VII with Aerith. For me, it was Call of Duty with Soldier, and you know, there it can occur. But with sandbox games, maybe that's where the future lies. And I'd like to get onto that in a second. But one game we were talking about Consequence and restarting regards Death. And I know in your article you mentioned one game where you couldn't really restart the game, and you know, just. The death that occurred was permanent. So I just wondered if you wanted to elaborate on that particular game, Jared.
You're probably talking about Urban Dead.
Right.
This is a game. It's a highly recommended, by the way, a massive multiplayer browser-based zombie versus humans game. And so the whole mechanic of the game is that you have a certain number of moves that you can make per day, and you're always that changes a lot of things, because at the end of your day, you always want to make sure you're inside of a safe house so you don't get killed. Because getting, you know, staying alive is very important. It's not like most zombie games, you know, Resident Evil, that kind of thing, where if you die, you see your death screen and then you start over again and keep going. If you die in Urban Dead, you turn into a zombie. So you turn into the very thing that you were trying to fight against. And to me, that was a really, like, horrible thing. You know, I mean, it was great. I loved it. But I desperately did not want to become a zombie. So, you know, I was just very careful about what I did. And if you die and you're a zombie, there is a process by which you could turn back into a human. It's kind of a whole rigmarole, and I'm not too thrilled with it. But I do like that idea of Death having a, you know, this great implication. It works really well with zombie games. But I really like the way Urban Dead did it. All the games that I mentioned in that article are not sandbox games. So I think that there's a way to handle Death differently. It doesn't have to be like, well, linear games handle Death this way and sandbox games handle Death this way. But it is a good way to sort of think about it for now, especially in terms of big budget games, because those are two very distinct models.
Right. Well, I mean, linear games have always, you know, kind of stuck to their guns and followed a certain, you know, distinct model that you know every other game has. So that's kind of why they all try and do the same things. But to see a game break out from that and, you know, trying something different, that's definitely really cool. And I hope to see more of that. So actually, this ties perfectly into what this all has been going. So with all the stuff that we've been seeing lately, all the choice, the morality, the different decisions in games, and everything that developers have been trying to do to perfect gaming narrative and implement death correctly, where do we see death in games evolving to? What's the ultimate point in this? What, in 5 years, do we see death becoming something different in games, or is it just going to be pretty much, you know, the same thing that we've been seeing for the past couple of things? How can death evolve as the technology and as developers get more, you know, developers want to involve players in more? Where do we see death going to in games?
Well, and we keep coming back to gray area. I guess I just think that I see there being more. I definitely see a change coming. I mean, we've definitely come a long way from just dying and restarting and not having any implications at all. And I see that increasing. And I'd like to see that continue, I guess, where there's more decisions to make and more modeling of the world as a result.
For me, I think what Jared was saying about the indie scene is pertinent, and I think that's where you're going to see the fruition of new ideas and new concepts with death and games. Like, I don't say by the 5 years from now, like you were saying, see the mainstream games making much headway, because we're in a different kind of shift now. We're in a casual shift, and I don't see death being part of the casual shift, really. I think one interesting concept I'd like to see, and maybe not it will see, but I would like to see is more emphasis on permadeath as a mechanic in video games. And I'd like to see someone integrate it into a game in a way that's appreciably frustrating, if that's not an oxymoron. And I think that would be really interesting, but I don't see it necessarily happening.
I just want to jump in and say that you know, in that article I talked about how, you know, to really take apart death the way that it is in games now, you kind of have to destroy a lot of the model of what games often are. That's why these indie games are great examples, because they really do things differently. So yeah, I mean, I think in the mainstream for things to change, it's going to be tough, because there has to be major changes in, you know, this whole idea of death being the penalty for failure. You know, so when you talk about permadeath, it conjures images of, you know, you mess something up in a game, you die, and you have to deal with that forever. And I don't think people are going to respond very well to that. But if you can present,
I don't think any gamer wants that, yeah, really.
Yeah, so I mean, it has to be about just changing that whole convention of, you know, trying to succeed, and if you don't, you die. That you know, that whole thing has to change. And I think of Passage, but that's so artsy that it's not something that I see easily coming over to the mainstream.
Exactly. I mean, along the same lines, I just really hope that Heavy Rain lives up to its potential and does something different and really, you know, tries to revolutionize the way that, you know, death is handled in a major title like that. And I hope that it really, I hope it doesn't cut corners. I hope that it really does what it's promised and lives up to its potential in both a gameplay standpoint and as a storytelling standpoint. And I think that, while it's not going to change things much, as Jared and Sinan said, the casual shift would not adapt to fit this type of thing. But if even just along major studio titles, if other games kind of pull from Heavy Rain, if it does well, then I would love to see where that would go.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot of off-show about Heavy Rain, and I'm almost certain that you're going to see a Big Red Potion episode completely devoted to it, whether it succeeds or fails in its goals, because it's doing so many fascinating different things. But as for this particular show, I think it's time to bring it to a close. And I've really enjoyed it. It's a subject that I think fascinates all of the participants. And I would highly recommend listeners to go read Jared's article at The Escapist. And what I'll do is I'll leave a link in the show notes. And so Jared, do you want to mention some of the sites and places that you work for?
Yeah, sure. For games, I'm writing at technologizer.com and gamesabyss.com. And I write about technology as well. I do that for cdfreaks.com and gearcrave.com. And also I'll give a shout out to my fiance Molly, who's totally stoked to hear the podcast. And thanks to you guys.
Oh, well, no, thank you to you. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. And hello, Molly.
All right. Brownie points.
Excellent. Right. So next week we're talking about narrative again, but more regards the Hollywood influence on it. And we're hopefully going to have two guests rather than one next week. Hopefully going to have Christos Reed, who's written for IGN before, and a name many listeners will probably already be familiar with, Kyle Orland, who writes now for Crispy Gamer, so that should be exciting. On to Joe's final thought, the best part of the show for many people. So, Joe, your final thought for this week.
I can kill you with my mind.
Wow. I'm not sure I can share my final thought now. I'm a bit intimidated. Maybe I'll just say bye, and hopefully we'll all join you next week, unless Joe kills me with his mind. So, bye. Thank you for listening to Big Red Potion, brought to you as part of the Game On network of podcasts from thegamereviews.com, home to unbiased thoughts from a community of gamers. You can find more about the podcast at bigredpotion.com, with links to previous shows and forum threads where you can continue the discussion. You can follow show updates through Twitter by following either myself at twitter.com/Shoinan, S-H-O-I-N-A-N, or Joe at twitter.com/SlamVanderHuge, Slam, V-A-N-D-E-R, Huge. All that's left to do is thank the man behind the theme tune, Derek K. Miller. Derek, take us out with Washing Off Like an Aardvark. I've not had the best of days, which I won't go into, but trying to psych myself up now to talk about death is like...
Well, yeah, if we're going to have a topic that'll spink you up a little bit, this will be it.
Exactly. Can we make next week's show about bunnies?
Yes. Bunnies, happiness, and flowers. I like it. Flower Tuesday. Search for more flowers.
Absolutely. Why not?